when you don't have a lot of it, it's the only thing that matters. When you have a lot of it, it's the only thing that doesn't matter. A much better way of like measuring how you're doing life-wise is, are you making enough money to fund the lifestyle that you want? And then are you actively taking advantage of that lifestyle? When you can make people laugh and they realize what you're making fun of, it both disarms the situation and it almost elevates you above it because you understood the trend enough to use it, and then you use it to make fun of itself. The cost of having your own miniature media operation have dropped to almost zero. People who are both good writers and good at content strategy are going to have a lot of opportunities if they know how to sell themselves.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Jack Raines. Jack is the writer of the Young Money blog and editor-in-chief of ExecSum. We talk about alternative life paths, the importance of travel, how to think about finances, writing, satire, university, prioritizing fun, and his first book that's in the works. Please enjoy. I wanted to start out by talking a bit about this idea of breaking out of conventional scripts and ways of living, which I think characterizes a lot of your living, but then writing as well, whether it's you turning 6K into 400K, you dipping from work and traveling for a year, or just your general kind of approach to how you do marketing and writing. I think we grow up thinking there's a lot of these like sequential gates, a lot of you pass go and collect $200 that people just have to go through. And I think you kind of speak to the other side of that. What are the loopholes or shortcuts or kind of third doors that you found that you recommend others explore as opposed to following this kind of conventional path?
I think something that people miss, especially in the like career navigation point of like being in your 20s, maybe a few years out of college, is there's like these ideas of like I don't know, like when you say conventional stuff, it is really the, like, whether you're applying for a job, you go through like company application portals or you look for job listings on LinkedIn. This is something that I've told more and more people about when like kind of describing how I've been navigating my stuff. There's a lot of opportunities out there that there might not be a job listing for right now, but if you can just get in front of the right person who's working on something adjacent to stuff that you're working on, and you both realize like there's an opportunity to work well together, it could kind of create its own job. And it might be something that starts off as like a one-off project, or just like I'm a big fan of offering to do early on, do some work for free to prove that you can, or if you've already gotten a little bit of a track record, like do one or two projects for a company. And then if it's something that works well for both parties where they both see value in it, keeping it going. But those type of conversations happen on emails and LinkedIn and Twitter DMs where, because when people are going through like the job application process, like companies are trying to maximize for a really wide funnel to get a lot of quality applicants. But if you're applying for one of those, it's really hard to differentiate yourself because the only difference is your resume, right? Versus if you can get somebody's inbox or DMs, or the like pre-internet version of this was like friend of a friend who tried to introduce you to somebody at like a cocktail party. Right. All of those are the same type of thing, right? It's just like giving you a lot more leverage to differentiate yourself and to get to know someone on a little more personal level. So for me, a lot of like what I've done over the last year or two is just kind of keeping every once in a while, just looking at, all right, like who's following me on Twitter that's interesting that might be somebody I could work with on some stuff. And in the last 6 months specifically, I've started like doing kind of a social media content consulting gig for a pretty big VC firm that's been trying to like overhaul their Twitter, LinkedIn strategy, and then also helping another company like build out a newsletter around an industry that they invest in, just from like grabbing coffee with some people, seeing what they're working on, and then saying, oh, like I've been doing this, I could probably help you guys with that. I think more people need to look for opportunities like that that just aren't the regular job stuff, because the odds are not in your favor at all when you're just one of 1,000 applicants for a job. Like they're going to take the most qualified person on paper. If you can actually get on the phone with somebody or meet with somebody in person, you have an opportunity to spin a narrative on like how what you do could help them that you just can't do through a generalized job application.
Absolutely. I've been harping on this job application process for years. I think it's so archaic and doesn't reflect the actual job that you're going to be doing. And so this idea of Jack Butcher has this phrase of permissionless apprenticeship that I've always loved and used, like exactly like you're saying. And I think you actually did this to some degree with Liquidity and ExecSum by reaching out to them. But this idea of go and find a place where you can add value and demonstrate it. Don't go through this conventional path of like hitting, you know, one click apply on LinkedIn, like 5,000 other people. And yet most people persist and continue to go that kind of well-worn path. Why do you think it is that more people don't go this route? Is it a function of like awareness? People just don't even think to do it? Or is it laziness or something else?
I think it's a mixture of awareness. And then also I think the bigger issue is that people get so like black and white binary about this, where you either have to do this super traditional thing or you have to just dive in the deep end and like found a startup and raise like VC capital or like do this or do that. Like, I don't know, like I started blogging when I still had a full-time job. Like most people that go and do their own thing, I mean, a few people will just dive right in. Like if you say you made a lot of money, sold a company for a lot of money, or you had a really lucrative career and you've got a big enough safety net that you can afford to not work for a year or two, that's different. But most people that end up like kind of charting their own path usually do it as an offshoot of what they're already doing. Like Jack Butcher was working for a marketing agency for a long time. And then he started taking on like one-off consulting gigs. And then it got to the point that he was essentially running his own agency. And then it got to the point that he had more demand than he could handle. So he kind of productized a lot of his stuff. And that was like a step-by-step iteration where if you look at him today, it's like, oh, Jack Butcher's like an artist, an influencer, a writer, a consultant. He does all this stuff. But like, it wasn't like he just decided to do what he's doing today 6 years ago, right? It went step-by-step. I think most people probably should have a normal job of normal company for a couple of years if for no other reason than to see how normal companies work. I think we over-glorify the whole like entrepreneurial hustle, doing your own thing. I think the better way to do it is start off within a larger organization, learn from it, and then start putting out feelers with other stuff as you see opportunities. Because like, there's no rules stopping you from, you know, like trying to tap into other stuff while you have a regular job. But I feel like a lot of people think you either have to be all in on a regular job or all in on your own thing. It's that being able to tap into that gray area or that Venn diagram overlap is a much lower risk way to experiment with other stuff, where if it doesn't work, you still have your salary. If it does work, you can keep doing it until you're making enough money to replace 60 or 70% of your salary. And then you can have a lot more confidence to go all in on something.
I think the risk that a lot of people run is that they get caught up in that salary and that 9-to-5 and don't want to exert that additional effort outside of that. I know I've experienced that in my own life. So I think maybe that's the bigger concern for people. They feel like it's got to be this all or nothing strategy because they only have this kind of fixed amount of energy to direct towards something.
Yeah.
But you touched on, I wanted to ask you kind of the opposite of my initial question around what are the loopholes or shortcuts? What are the things, what are the common scripts in life that you feel like are valid and worth adopting? It sounds like getting a 9-to-5 for some period of time so you can have that baseline salary, get some kind of reputation and skill set. Are there other things in life, or maybe even going deeper into that one, that you feel like, no, these are things that people shouldn't kind of shove to the side? These are valid for a reason.
Yeah, I think maybe not a 9-to-5, but it's good to work for somebody else at some point. It could be like I worked for UPS, which would be the definition of like a just big Fortune 500 company. It could be working for like a Series B level startup, but either way, like working on a team with other people is good because you instantly pick up on what works, what doesn't work. Like there were things about UPS that I did like on how organized everything was. Like there was always a resource for everything. What I didn't like was some of the kind of just bloat you get when a company gets too big, where there's almost too many processes here and there. But that's something that I wouldn't really know unless I'd experienced that. Versus like doing the stuff with Liquidity, it's just a few of us that are kind of running a newsletter, social media, like media company. So it's a lot more firing from the hip, figuring stuff out. And that gets a little stressful too, because there isn't really a set schedule or cadence, and it's a lot more like self-starter. It's good to do a couple of those. I think it'd be good for most people to work for a large company for a little bit and a smaller company or group to figure out what they like. And you'll know within 6 months, like what things you like and don't like from either of those. I think another thing, and this is like less work related, but you're talking about the travel stuff earlier. I think pretty much every young person who can afford to should travel for at least like a 2 month period in their lives. And I also think that like, if you're smart with your finances, pretty much anybody can afford to do that by the age of 25. Like if you start off with like zero money graduating from college and you're making 50 or 60K a year with like an entry level job, as long as you just budget like $500 a month that you're putting back, $400 a month, you'll save up a few thousand dollars where whenever you're looking for that next job, or you're switching jobs, or maybe you're going back to grad school or whatever, you can like bake in 6 weeks, 7 weeks to just go somewhere new and see it. For me, that like, I think sometimes the whole like, oh, you need to travel becomes like a little bit of a cliche, because it's become so much of like a, like an Instagrammable thing, right? Like who can take the coolest pictures and put them out there. But there's something to me, there's something very cool about like going to a country where a lot of people don't speak your language. You don't really know anybody. I'm just trying to figure it out. It's as much a self-discovery thing of like how foreign of an environment can you put yourself in and make it work? And also like how many interesting people can you meet that you wouldn't normally encounter, whether it's other travelers from like other parts of the US or England or Spain or whatever, or just like even the difference between talking to like my barber or like a bartender I know in New York versus like trying to get to know the equivalent in Madrid or Sevilla. Like there's a lot of, I don't know, everybody who has traveled a good bit, like or traveled a decent amount when they're younger, always talks about all the upside from it, everything they got from it. I've never heard anybody complain about it. That's like travel's probably the only thing where nobody ever said it was a waste of time, right? Like some people might think that you should keep doing it more and more than other people do, but like everybody thinks it was valuable. And then I also think that maybe I'm biased because I am a writer, but I think everybody should like, even if they don't have any intention of like monetizing or like building a big audience on it, like publish some of their thoughts on the internet, because the cost of having a personal blog now is $0. And whether it's career stuff or just like trying to connect with other humans better, like you can't really fake written word, right? Like it's one of those skills that's valuable in any, like it doesn't matter what you're doing for work. It doesn't matter just how you orient your life. Being able to articulate yourself in written word is a useful thing, because like humans connect over stories, right? So if you can better articulate your point, you could be worse at something with somebody else, but if you can explain it better, you have an inherent advantage. If you've written your thoughts on literally anything, somebody else can read those thoughts and see like if you're aligned on how you think about stuff. Like it's like long form writing is, it's like a resume can be faked or spoofed or whatever. Like you, as soon as you read something, you know if it's good or not, you know what somebody thinks about something. Like it's a much better like proof of work and proof of thought than a resume is. So I guess like the three things are, I think everybody should spend some time in a big organization and a small organization. I think that like everybody, especially when they're younger, should spend some amount of time like traveling somewhere that puts them out of their comfort zone. And then I'd think that pretty much everybody should at some point write a little bit and put those thoughts out there and be willing to share them with the world.
It was a nice conclusion, like a well done three or five paragraph essay there.
Thank you.
I think for all these things, I agree. And I think with the exception of travel, which I think a lot of people talk about and agree to your point that like travel is worth doing. I think some people, whether valid or not, will make excuses for, oh, I can't travel, with the exception of that. I think some of these other things, though, you seem to have kind of this macro perspective or orientation towards life that a lot of, like, at least at the time, early 20-year-olds don't have. I don't think they think about the world in the same way that you do, or else we would have kind of fewer people working in multi-thousand person corporations and more people doing kind of freelance internet type work. What is it that you feel like you've realized at a macro level about reality, the world, people, that has everything else has kind of trickled from?
Something that, I don't know if this would be macro or not, but I think a very common theme that I've just seen over and over and over again in people is, I've written about this type of like just general theme a lot, is like the first half of your life, people will spend all their time like worried about making as much money as possible. And part of that's like a scarcity thing of like the fear of not being able to provide for yourself, for your family, for your kids. Like I think people with money often oversimplify the idea that like, I'm going to take a step back and format this a little bit better. I think people, sure, like there's, when it comes to financial advice, I think people like oversimplify it on two fronts. Either people are making advice just markets towards like poor people or people that are just getting started, like make more money than you spend, pay down your debt, like very pragmatic financial advice that helps you get from like -1 to 0 or 0 to 1. And then there's this higher level financial advice that is the, oh, like money is like the least valuable asset, you should invest more and all this other stuff. And I used to think a lot more stronger that way. I've written plenty about it. I have a blog called 6 Types of Wealth where I'm literally quantifying how like health, time, experience, and relationships are a lot more important than money. What I missed then that I think I have a better understanding of now, and this is something that all people go through as their income scales, is early on, money is very much a scarcity thing where when you don't have much of it, like you can't even focus on those bigger, more esoteric things because like you literally need to pay rent, pay your bills, pay off student debt. Like you have little kids that you're trying to feed. Like you literally just have to keep putting money on the table. And then once you get to the point that money is just a commodity where you don't really have to worry about it anymore, then making more and more and more of it becomes like kind of frivolous, right? Like the difference between having like $30 million in the bank and $300 million in the bank on like the, like how much you enjoy your life or the like tangible things you can get with that are pretty negligible at that point. What I think a lot of people miss is that like everybody runs through, it's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We all run through this like money, like it's not that money is more or less important than anything else. It's when you don't have a lot of it, it's the only thing that matters. When you have a lot of it, it's the only thing that doesn't matter. What we miss is on the way up, we get so caught up in the like having to make more and more money. And it's hard to stop doing that once we don't need more. And it's also once people have a lot of money, they almost forget what it was like to not. So I think that there are just so many misconceptions about money. And this is like an idea that I've started thinking more and more about the last few months, is there's so many misconceptions about money and wealth where it's really just people with completely different perspectives, like yelling over each other where nobody's right or wrong. I used to think it was just people would have a quarter life or midlife crisis when they were like 50 and realize, oh shit, I need to reorient my life. But it's not that. It's just like you literally can't focus on the other stuff until you have money. And most people don't have money until that point. So something that I think would be healthy for a lot of people would be to just realize how more money makes your perception change, instead of it just being a static, oh, money's less important than this stuff. No, money becomes less important than health and relationships and time and experiences once you have money. But like you can't worry about any of that stuff if you don't have money because you're broke. So I think that's especially like the way society works, like money becomes a less and less valuable asset the more of it that you have. But until you have that critical mass, it is literally the only thing that matters. And I think living in New York has made me more cognizant of that, because honestly, I'm making more money now than I did in Atlanta 2 years ago, but I'm probably spending 3 times as much, right? Like it's when you're paying $3,000 a month for rent versus like $950, like that rent expense is on the back of your head or on the back of your mind. So yeah, I think the most constant thing, and I think it explains so much human behavior, is how money depending on what your wealth level is, money goes from being a like literal survival life or death thing to just a commodity like air and water like that. And it's just a multi-year process for most people, so they don't really realize how it changed. They think it's like, oh, wow, I've had this like internal awakening that money's less important. No, you just have money now. So it doesn't matter as much. And I don't think that's really clicked with people a lot, because I didn't really think about money like that until the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's almost like this escape velocity to money where it's like you just feel this gravitational pull until you hit this certain mark. And then you're out kind of floating in space. And it's like, okay, I've got some breathing room here. I can figure out what I want to do with the money.
Yeah.
I think there's like multiple studies have been done that like show the diminishing returns of additional money passed at something like 70 or 100K or something time and time again. But I think people's lifestyles always are to your point of like when you moved from Atlanta to New York, your lifestyle scaled.
For sure.
So even though you're making more money, you had more money going out as well. So I think people are just constantly ratcheting up just a little bit with their salary bumps. And the other thing is people often don't know what they actually want to do with that money because they've been caught in this scarcity mindset for so long, which is what like somebody like Ramit Sethi always talks about is like, what is your rich life?
Yeah.
And people get caught up in these games of like, oh, I see this keeping up with the Joneses of, oh, I see what they're doing over here with their money. Maybe I should be doing that. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't get out of that kind of out of orbit to begin with. They're always caught in that survival phase of it. I want to ask one final question around this idea of like life scripts and kind of questioning them. Again, this is what a lot of like, what's interesting to me about what you've done and your writing kind of circles this area. And yet you chose to get your MBA. I think this was a decision you actually made a while ago and you kind of like deferred enrollment.
Yeah.
But for somebody who's so active on the internet, has a good following, has already started to develop professional relationships where you could, I mean, you're kind of already, I would imagine making close to what you would consider a full-time salary.
Yeah.
You could go in and press the accelerator on this. Why did you go and get your MBA? What was it that you thought you could only get from that experience that you couldn't get elsewhere?
I think it's pretty easy to get caught in the Twitter internet bubble and like get almost detached from the real world. And for context, I probably wouldn't have applied to business school a year or two ago if I wasn't already in. But like you alluded to, I got into Columbia my senior year of college in 2019 through a deferred enrollment program. So like typically with business school, you would work like 4 years and then apply, then start school. In my case, I got in out of undergrad and then just had to work a few years and then I could start. It probably did help that my like default inertia at that point was to go to school because I was already enrolled. Like I would have had to tell them I didn't want to go. Otherwise I was like going to matriculate last year. That being said, I did think a lot about like, do I even need business school? Does it match up with my goals? Does it matter? And it hit me that it would still be really useful for me, even if I didn't need business school to get a job, for the network aspect of like having a lot of friends around my age doing all sorts of stuff, whether they were going, some of them are going into banking and consulting, some of them are going to work for VC firms or work for startups. And like business school was a very good like filter for people who are like pretty, I don't know, like high agency, like pushing themselves to do stuff. And it's an inflection point of a lot of those people are really trying to narrow down and navigate like what they're going to do next, go into their late 20s and their 30s. So I thought it would give me like a pretty valuable network of people doing a lot of interesting stuff. I thought it would give me exposure to people that weren't in my same internet bubble, like almost a like snap back to reality. Like it's very easy to get caught up in that, just like being terminally online all the time, just talking to people you know through Twitter. But most people aren't on Twitter, right? And those people are still engaged in finance and like real world stuff. So I think that the quality of like what I write is very dependent on the quality of my inputs, and having that network of people has been very useful for me just to have new perspectives on a lot of different stuff. I wanted to move to New York. I figured that was probably the best move. Again, just like geographically, there's way more people in New York or coming to New York that I knew that I would want to meet with and just get to know. And business school was honestly a forcing function for me to make me come here versus just doing the digital nomad thing and continuing to travel indefinitely. And something that I probably discounted too much a couple of years ago, that I'm realizing matters more and more now, is there's still such an advantage and a benefit to having like a strong, just like pedigree brand association. It's the same thing. Like, I used to think it was stupid that people go and work for Goldman Sachs because I thought the work was going to be boring. I now realize that, like, in the real world, Goldman Sachs is a name that carries a ton of weight. And all things being equal, you're going to get more opportunities than somebody else from that. And you're also going to have a network of other Goldman alumni, like coworkers, that affiliation matters to them. Columbia Business School is the same thing for me. Like, yeah, I've done a good job of building this internet following and this and that, but it's a lot more powerful kind of winning the Twitter game and then also being in a really good business school and then deciding to go work for this company or that company than it is to like just do the Twitter thing and do that company. It's like, I would have had the opportunity to go work for like a McKinsey or a Goldman, and instead I'm choosing to do this stuff versus like only being able to do this stuff. And it just makes it a lot easier to like position myself as an authority on a lot of stuff, and honestly just gives more weight to all the decisions I make because I had a decent amount of like high caliber options.
I think there's absolutely something to be said about winning this IRL game and winning the URL game, which is something I've been coming around to more recently. Like, I think coming out of the pandemic, we had this kind of predisposition towards sit in our house and do Zoom things, both for work and like for kind of personal reasons. And like the pendulum feels like it's swung back towards the middle and maybe even going back towards IRL a bit, where people are realizing the value of kind of your geographical zip code as opposed to your digital one. And so it makes sense that you'd want to try to develop relationships and opportunities through both spaces. And I think yet I'll push on it a little bit and ask, like, if you're trying to cultivate a single strength, which I think for you is like digital writing, like your unique take on things and your ability to distribute that and amplify it online, why not double down through that existing network and kind of system rather than going in person and trying to build like some kind of competency or network there as well?
Honestly, I think I would have just gotten really bored if I was just sitting in my room all day on my desk, like just typing away on my laptop. I like being around people in person. And I prefer working in a study room on campus. And then when I take a break, like I'm just hanging out with people that I'm friends with versus sitting at my desk and taking a break and like walking a lap around the block with a bunch of strangers coming back in. Like to your point about how you feel like the pendulum swinging back to the kind of IRL stuff, I thought business school would be the most like concentrated version of that IRL stuff, especially coming out of the pandemic. And I kind of just craved that. So a big part of it probably wasn't even I do think there were a lot of career benefits to it, but like, no, I think that I probably could have had a slightly more lucrative last year or two off of just like tripling down on the writing stuff, like working on the monetization side of that. I think I've had a lot more enjoyable last 2 years just holistically having the business school thing. And like going forward, I know that I'm going to be spending a lot more time kind of like zoned in on the writing stuff over the next few years, because most of my peer group is going to be like back in the office working and stuff like that. But that kind of makes sense because it's like, they're all doing their thing with work. I will too. I kind of wanted this 2 year period of, okay, maybe I'm only like putting out 60 to 70% of the output that I normally would because of the school stuff, but I'm getting all the social benefits of this group. These are going to be relationships I'm going to have for a long time. Like if you look at it through the lens of, is this the most productive use of my time? Dollar for dollar, probably not. Is it the most enjoyable use of my time that might give me a longer term benefit down the road, like more call options on things that could turn into big opportunities? 100%. Like I agree that my biggest strength is digital writing. One of the most lucrative things a writer can do is speaking engagements, especially if you've published a book. And there's no telling like who that I go to school with is going to be working for a company that's putting on an event that's willing to pay $20,000 to a speaker. They call Jack Rains. Like, there's there's a lot of just things like that that are probably going to have a lot of like tail end upside that just haven't emerged yet. But they all will end up coming back to like me going to business school.
Yeah, there's absolutely something to the like geographical serendipity that comes as a result of it.
For sure.
And I think for all the flack that university has caught over the last couple of years, largely as a result of COVID, I think the hardest thing to disrupt is exactly what you're pointing to, that like density of people in a common location at a similar stage in life and the energy that comes from that, especially in New York.
Yeah.
And that's like, you can't reproduce that online.
I think that the university thing is interesting because I agree that there's a lot of issues with universities. Like, I think like they're very poor at allocating capital, which is why tuition rates have gone up way higher than like the general inflation rate. I do think it's funny that like a lot of the loudest like anti-university colleges and necessary proponents, most of them went to university and probably directly benefited from their university. Like, there's this whole Silicon Valley bubble of people that are like, oh, like Harvard's terrible, it's gone too woke, this or that. Like, you can definitely critique some of the like public facing stances of universities. I don't think they're perfect, but like very few people who are anti-university didn't go to university. And it's very much like the outlier and not the norm that people who, because even a lot of people who did, like Sam Altman, he went to Stanford for like a year before he dropped out. And like, he got into Stanford and went there and realized there was a better use of his time working on a startup in the 90s. Like, that kind of makes sense. He probably benefited a lot from being in that Stanford bubble. And there's a whole signal of the difference between being someone who dropped out of Stanford and someone who never went to Stanford are two entirely different things, right? So I think college gets a bad rap. I think like the university system needs to get cleaned up a lot. I think they probably maybe dabble in politics too much. They probably spend too much money on like frivolous admin expenses, but it's a social experience that really can't be replicated anywhere else. And that is valuable. People miss that.
I'm in that camp. I'm guilty of having gone to college and benefited from it, but I wouldn't say I go as far as to be anti-college. I think I just encourage people to question why it is they're going and, why they're going, when they're going, because I think there's a lot of optionality there, especially today. There's other options or paths you can take.
Yeah.
I do want to go back to something you said a minute ago. You said dollar for dollar, college probably isn't the best use of my time if I'm purely looking at like a financial outcome. And I think in your writing or in a previous podcast episode, you said something to the effect of whoever has the most fun wins.
Yeah,
which to me points to what it is you're like optimizing for, or what's at the top of your value or motivation stack. Is fun like the singular thing you're optimizing for? And if so, why is that the most important thing to you?
For sure. I would say that my definition of fun has probably changed a little bit over the last 3 years, just as like I've gotten a little bit older. Like,
okay.
My
definition, I'd love to hear the evolution of that.
Well, okay. So my definition of fun at like newly turning 24 and having made some money trading stocks was, we can go more into this too in a second, but the like very simple summary is I did, as you mentioned at the beginning, turn like 6K to 400K. I then blew half of that on a bad trade, stopped trading. But I was sitting there with like, I don't know, like $200,000 in the bank that I shouldn't have had. And I was like, and I knew I was going to a good business school a year later. And this was like August 2021, pandemic travel restrictions are coming down. And also like I was a newly single guy too, with very little, like I just didn't really have that many responsibilities and I didn't need a job, especially a job I wasn't that interested in. So I just figured the most like both fun and interesting and probably like beneficial way of spending the next year would probably be just travel as much as possible. Let's go to as many interesting places as possible. Like, how many people am I going to meet that have cool stories or whatever? I'm 24. If I want to like go out 8 nights in a row, 14 nights in a row in Barcelona, who cares? Like, I can do that. It's not really going to like impact my life at all. And this is sort of the last time to do anything like that. I think I might have over-indexed towards the like, well, this is my last chance to do like young, reckless stuff. I don't know if that's the right way to necessarily look at how you should orient your life, but it was for a little bit. When I was 24, and I had a lot of fun doing it, and it didn't really set me back at all work-wise. I think now, like, I still put travel as a premium, but it's not like, oh, let's go to a party town in Europe, like Barcelona or like whatever version you want to use, and then just rip it for a couple of weeks. Now it's like I'm planning on going to India with one of my friends from business school who's Indian, like staying with his family, seeing the Taj Mahal, like all this type of stuff, Indian cuisine, like a lot of stuff that I just wouldn't do, but I think is fascinating. But I find that stuff to be fun. I like literally just hanging out with my friends, doing friend stuff, whether that's playing poker every week. I'm playing on like Colombia's rugby team against other rugby teams, like stuff like that's fun. We rented an RV in October and just did like an 8-day RV trip around Utah, like 8 dudes in an RV. I thought that was a lot of fun. I'm not as good at it as I'd like to be, but trying to learn Spanish, like learning a new language, that's fun. Like all of this stuff, to me, fun is synonymous at this point with stuff that's interesting, new, and like intellectually satisfying. While 2 years ago, it probably would have been a lot more just honestly, whatever your college definition of fun is. But regardless of what it is, I like having enough money that I can double down on whatever thing I think is fun at the time and enjoy it without having to worry about it. I think that if you don't have enough money, you can't afford to do things that you would find fun, because plane tickets cost money. Spanish lessons cost money. Eating in nice restaurants cost money. If you're making too much money, and it's not that making too much money is the problem, but if the things that you're doing to make too much money are taking up too much of your time or even too much of your headspace, I don't know, like a lot of people, there are a lot of people in the Twitter subset of people that have like kind of figured out how to make internet money, that they have a business going well, or they're a creator who's like doing really well, build a big audience. And they're always thinking, okay, like how do I build a business out of this, or spend 2 businesses out of this, or this or that? And it's like, you don't need the extra money, and you're just manufacturing more and more and more jobs for you, where you basically, instead of having like a 40 to 50 hour a week job, you have like 40 or 50 hours a week of working, and then another 40 to 50 hours a week of like thinking about more work that you could be doing where you can't even have fun. So I think when people do that, they kind of miss the point. It's like they have all the, some people really enjoy that stuff. So if that is your level of fun, like you like building stuff that makes money, go all in. That is awesome. I'm not quite oriented that way. And I don't know. Like I think a much better way of like measuring like how you're doing life-wise is, are you making enough money to fund the lifestyle that you want? And then are you actively taking advantage of that lifestyle? Like if not, it's not great.
You admitted early on that you need a certain amount of money to enable the lifestyle you want. This goes back to like the very first conversation or topic we had at the beginning. Do you feel like for yourself, your current fun was a bit enabled by luck, like you turning $6,000 into ultimately $200,000?
Oh, for sure. I don't try to claim to be some guru. I will say that I knew what I was doing when I made the money, and it was a bubble. Like SPACs were a very niche part of the market, and I knew it was a bubble. And like I knew what I was doing when I traded it. When I lost all the money, the SPAC bubble had popped, and I just figured that, oh, I made enough money off of that. I can probably just keep wheeling and dealing, like day trading other stuff, because I was good at this one thing. It's like an NBA player saying, oh, I'm going to go play like pro baseball. I mean, Michael Jordan kind of did it, but he wasn't as good. Like, nobody else would be able to pull that off. Just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean you're going to be like that skill set is going to translate to a similar thing. And I had way too much confidence in my ability to take advantage of one niche bubble over an 8-month period and extrapolated that, and I shouldn't have, and I lost money on that. But that entire scenario was very luck-based. Like, I should have just been working my normal job and this and that. That being said, if I wasn't trading stocks and was actually focusing on my job like I probably should have been, I probably would have gotten an extra promotion or two. Like, I intentionally sandbagged my job because I didn't want a promotion, because I didn't want that extra time commitment that would have come with that, because I was making money trading stocks. It would have taken probably an extra 9 months, but I could have saved up enough money that I could have done like a 4-month trip before business school if I wanted to. Like, it wouldn't have the end result still would have been me doing about the same thing before school started. I could just be a little more frivolous with my spending on it because of the luck aspect.
So there's usually still alternate pathways for people
for sure.
to experience some or prioritize some amount of fun, at least at the beginning, but always enabled by some amount of money. Implicitly, a lot of what we've been talking about is this idea of like opportunity cost, and being able to do one thing at the expense of another or vice versa. I'm curious about some of the opportunity costs or trade-offs that you feel like you've been willing to accept that maybe you have a high tolerance for that other people aren't. And so maybe this one we were just talking about, like the trade-off at a certain point between fun and money is one of those. But are there other kind of key dichotomies or trade-offs or opportunity costs that you feel like you're predisposed to accepting that other people don't, and as a result, maybe don't get as much enjoyment out of life?
Yeah, I think the fun and money is the most obvious one. But the caveat is like within the context that I'm confident that my earning power will keep going up over time based off of how things are scaling. Like, it's not a throw caution to the wind and like YOLO, I'm going to do whatever I want. Screw the money. Like, I'm pretty meticulous about mapping out like this whole, like always looking at, are there any projects that look interesting that I can help people with? Like, what's the, like, I'm always kind of talking to people about things where like, I've got a phrase that I used to describe a couple of my friends who seem to be really good at making money, that they have a money button where like they just seem to have stuff that prints money for them. I think it's good to, even if you don't have a money button, know some people who have a money button that can loop you in on stuff. Like I'm happy with how my stuff's going now, but I'm willing to like kind of like put my head down and grind on some stuff for a month or so if needed to make sure I stay at a point that I can keep kind of leveraging for whatever I want. So yeah, the fun versus money trade-off, like I probably have a slightly higher risk tolerance than most people, but that comes from a spot of confidence that, like, I'm not worried about losing my job tomorrow and then like I'm just not gonna have money anymore. Like the things that I'm doing to make money, I'm self-employed, even though I'm working for liquidity still, like I'm on paper a contractor for that. And I have a few things like that with a few different people. I make money selling ads on my blog. Like I've got a pretty diversified enough revenue stream that it's given me the like freedom to kind of optimize for the fun stuff.
Is it more of a kind of like emotional, pre-rational, like confidence and abundance mindset? Or is it this more like analytical, I've been doing it this way and it's been working and I see this trajectory, and so I can like plot out, I'm going to make this much money next month, or I can exert 10 hours of additional effort and I'll get this output. I'm trying to assess, like, is it just this kind of general orientation of like good things will come if I do what I'm curious about or having fun doing? Or is it this more rational, like, yeah, things are going well, they're continuing on an upward trajectory, and I know I can tap into that?
It's both. On the, like, it used to be very analytical where if I was making like X amount of money on blog ad revenue, then as my blog scaled to this size, I'm making this much more. What I didn't take into account on that was if the ad market tanks while my readership grows, right, those rates are going to stay flat, which is essentially what's happened. I think a lot of people have noticed that across the ad market, like everywhere, social media, whatever. But as I've gotten a bigger and bigger following, like it's been easier for me to reach out to people and just say like, hey, what are you working on? And then it's like they're trying to figure out their content strategy or trying to build this or build that. I've been able to charge more and more money for like one-off projects or potential like recurring stuff. Like I've been talking to a group about paying me like $5,000 or $6,000 a month starting in January for like, it's a pretty active thing. Like I'll be spending a decent amount of time on it, but helping map out like social media strategy, repurposing like newsletter articles for social content. And that's more money than I could have charged a year ago for the same thing, just because I've got a bigger profile now. So I do have a high degree of confidence in my ability to find work that'll pay me a decent amount, but I'm also keeping track of like, what am I getting paid by these groups? Like do I have other leads that I have a high degree of confidence they'll turn into stuff? So it's not like blind optimism, but I'm also not like just spreadsheet counting like every dollar every month.
We, to shift direction slightly, but on the note of content, right before we started recording, we were talking about this idea of authenticity. And I think this is like intimately connected with prioritizing fun. But there are like kind of well-known, I'll call them like content formulas that people utilize across, whether it's, I guess for you, Twitter or LinkedIn or email newsletter, that you can reliably use to grow your audience and business, but maybe you sacrifice some authenticity to do that. I guess first, do you feel like you use these inauthentic kind of templates at all? And if not, how do you avoid giving into the crowd and the game just to up your subs and to up your advertising revenue? How do you stay focused on authenticity?
So I was looking down because I was looking at my phone to pull up a tweet that I put out yesterday where I totally just caught on a hot trend. Like it's not like a binary thing. There's a sliding scale. Like there's on the far like growth hacking side, it's okay, what kind of content like on LinkedIn are carousels performing better than regular posts? Like we have the images or on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it now. Like Elon tweeted today that if you put something as a highlight on your profile, it's going to get more engagement. Like there are tactics that work. There's the, I've tested before, do I think the long form tweets get more engagement than posting a thread? Like boom, boom, boom. I still haven't really figured it out. I think it depends on if the content is more of a like listicle or step-by-step thing versus, like, I think if you're writing like paragraphs, like almost like a blog, it's better to do long form. I think if it's different steps or stages or connected but separate ideas, it's better to do like a thread format. Like I do that stuff too. Everybody does that. Like, and if there is a like hot topic, like OpenAI has been the thing everybody's talking about. If I have something I think will be funny or good that relates to that, I'll do it. Like I put a thread out that said OpenAI drama, except it's the Game of Thrones cast. And like,
I saw that.
If you just scroll down, but it's gotten like a million impressions. Like this was, that wasn't just a, oh yeah, this is the most important thing I want to write about. It's completely unrelated to current events. Like I'm tapped into what's going on. I think the difference is even though I geared what I was posting about to what's going on, I still kept my sort of like sarcastic, funny vibe when putting that together, right? So I think that as long as the tone is consistent with how you put stuff, like people can just kind of tell if something's engagement bait, but the difference between engagement, like what I put was engagement bait, right? But if people think it's funny or interesting, then I'm not really that worried about it. Like, okay, I formatted this in a way that I thought it was going to get clicks. You could say that's just what marketing is in general, right? Like trying to get attention on the stuff. I think when you're trying to add value, whether that's educational, entertainment, humor, whatever, to other people and you get engagement from it, that's like, I pay $10 or $12 at Chipotle for a burrito. Like they make food, I pay for it. Like that's a completely fine trade-off. If I'm giving people something valuable on their timeline and they like it or retweet it, cool. So I see no issues with leaning into some of those growth tactics as long as the content's actually good. What's annoying is the like, there will be little group chats of like, hey, retweet my thing, I'll retweet yours. Like a lot of accounts have built up really big off of that. And once they
it's
hit
a parent like, with the bigger it, accounts,
it's
you know
so ridiculous. And once they hit a critical mass, like the content just devolves to what's the lowest common denominator of like, how can I reach the most people? Like there's all these accounts that have 10,000 followers. They are posting super like interesting detailed stuff, like nerding out on some topic. It's like, oh yeah, like 1400s politics, like Byzantine Empire, Ottomans, sick. And then it's like how to live a good life. Come on. Like that's not, right. I get that you're going to reach more people with that, but it's obvious when people do that. So I think just like continuing to post in a tone that's consistent to you. And for me personally, like my blog posts are just what I want to write about. Like that is the most authentic version you're going to get. Mm-hmm. Like I'll gear the social media a little bit towards like, I see nothing wrong with posting something that's funny, that's related to the current thing on Twitter. If it's going to get impressions and some of those will funnel back to my newsletter. I'm completely cool with that, but like the blog's going to be very authentic. And the tone that I put the stuff in on Twitter and LinkedIn or whatever is still going to be like my voice. Like, I'm not going to start like I'm not going to take like a Ryan Holiday, like stoic approach to all this stuff. That's not how I write. Like, that's his tone. Right. Like, I'm not going to copy him or like what somebody else does. That's not me.
I feel like you've had a good grasp, at least as long as I've been following you, you've had a good grasp on what your kind of tone and approach and strength is, particularly this like comedic element. And a lot of people call it shitposting. I would say some of your stuff is intentionally. Other stuff is just like generally comedic. Aside from that coming naturally to you, do you feel like there are maybe important messages, but just messaging in general that you can get through comedy that you can't get through in just kind of this more plain speak?
Yeah, I think the first time I actually really realized how I felt about comedy as a medium was when I was seeing just the like people posting threads on stupid stuff on Twitter. It was the most egregious form of engagement bait. Like, here's 10 Google Chrome hacks you have to know, or like 10 shortcuts on Excel you have to know. And then they're showing some course at the end. I'm like, okay. My first instinct was, I'm going to talk shit about this. And then I thought about it and I was like, no, because nobody really likes engaging with angry posts. Like, whenever, even if somebody's right, I remember seeing a spat on Twitter like 2 months ago. It was two people that I like and respect. And one of them, like, somebody called somebody out on a podcast, kind of. And then somebody just started like tweeting like, no, this wasn't true, this and this, and it just gave off the like that meme of like the dumb guy and the smart guy, and then they're just freaking out in the middle. It was just like the midwit, and I was like, I don't want to look like that. I can sarcastically play along with this trend, but it's just so dripping in sarcasm, I'm obviously making fun of it. I don't really know what it is about that, but like, when you can make people laugh and they realize what you're making fun of, it both disarms the situation and it almost elevates you above it, because you understood the trend enough to use it, and then you use it to make fun of itself. So at the like peak of the thread stuff, I put out this like, I don't know if you guys knew this, but like every single word in the English language is made of the same 26 letters. Here's the 26 letters that you have to know. And I made a thread of every letter in the alphabet, and it was like the letter Q. This one looks like a fat sperm cell, like all this stuff. It got 428,000 likes and like 30 million impressions. I'm still mad that Twitter didn't have that like ad monetization split at that point, because I would have made probably $10,000 from that thread. But when I put that out, I was like, damn, that people like that because it was stupid and funny, but it was also, it wasn't like the just copying pasting like an iFunny meme from 2012. It was like like, it took a second level order of thinking to use that format to make fun of itself. And I kind of doubled down on that on LinkedIn, making fun of hustle culture and this and that, with posts that look like they could be hustle culture. And I think that like Morgan Housel, I'm going to butcher the quote, but he said something in a blog post about how he thinks that comedy is like one of the highest forms of intelligence, because you both understand stuff going on well enough to make a joke about it that people like. And instead of like using your intelligence to kind of like stroke your own ego or like write a detailed paper showing, like, instead of showing people how smart you are, you care more about making other people laugh and enjoy themselves than you do about like getting your own sense of pride off of people thinking you're smart. And I kind of subscribe to the same thing. Like, making people laugh is tough. Like, it's very hard to be funny and to be funny consistently when the topics are changing. If I knew that on social media, I would much rather like that kind of be my thing. Like, I've never met somebody who said, I know you from Twitter, or I know you from LinkedIn, and I hate you. It's usually, oh, your stuff's hysterical. And when you're starting from the, oh, I think you're funny, and then I start telling people other stuff I do, it's like, oh, he's funny and he has depth. It's like when people see my LinkedIn shit post, and then I put like a really detailed like blog post on how I think that a good way to map your life out is think about when you're 80 years old, look back on what you would have accomplished over the course of your life. It's like, oh shit, this guy's got range. But it's much easier to do that than, it's way easier to convince people to think that a funny person is smart than that an angry person is smart, you know? So I think comedy, if you can pull it off, is just I would much rather people who didn't know me to think I'm funny than think I'm anything else.
Well said. Do you feel like, and maybe you haven't been online enough or frankly alive enough, maybe neither of us have, to answer this, but do you feel like people's response to comedy is changing, maybe in a negative way at all? And we could point to things like cancel culture or outrage culture or whatever. And this may just be symptomatic of the fact that, like, when you're online, you're behind your screen, you can say whatever shit you want. And people aren't gonna, you know, like, lash out at you physically in the real world. So you have a bit of a defense here. But do you feel like people have gotten more outraged or more negative towards things that, like, push buttons or maybe feel like they're stretching the Overton window?
Yeah, I don't think that people have changed. I think the internet has changed, like, both the speed at which we can react to stuff and, like, the mindset that we're in when we come across it. Like, I don't know, 50 years ago, if you were part of a union and you were protesting against a company, if you're going on strike and you're going to protest, like, you know that you are going there to protest. Social media, with the way the algorithms work, is like, if you're reading a bunch of, let's say, like, far right, conservative, politically charged tweets, like, Joe Biden's a piece of shit, this and that, and then you're reading all of that over and over again. And then, so that's what your timeline mainly is. And then there's a satirical piece by The Onion that's saying, like, I don't know, something bad about Joe Biden, but it's obviously making fun of, like, Republican commentary about Joe Biden. But your algorithm doesn't pick up that it's satire. It ends up in your bubble. You instantly lash out at that. So I think, one, you can encounter comedy when you don't expect it now based off of how the algorithm works, which makes people much more likely to lash out against it. And two, people can get more and more in their little echo chambers in general because, again, for how that works. So I think people are just coiled a lot tighter. And it's just easier to say something on the internet really mean where you just, like, type something and send it. Like, I don't know. People have fired off some pretty messed up stuff to me on, like, in my LinkedIn comment sections. They don't realize I'm putting satire out there. But they would never say in person. Like, somebody might, like, if I was giving a speech in, like, an auditorium at Columbia, I could say some pretty messed up stuff that people just disagreed with that they felt was pretty heinous. Nobody's going to come up to me and tell me to go fuck myself. Like, that's just not, that's not how you act in a civil society. You can say it on the internet, though, because you're never going to see that person. So I think it's, the internet has removed a lot of people's inhibitions, and it has just, like, people have their own little camps where their algorithm is, and occasionally content from another camp will just, like, airdrop into this really charged camp, and people just don't like it and hate it and start throwing rocks at it. Human behavior hasn't changed at all. It's just, like, the intensity at which, like, we encounter stuff has changed.
100%. Switching gears slightly, but touching on something you mentioned a few minutes ago, this idea of post you had written where you said, if I'm 80 years old, maybe I'm towards the end of my life and I'm looking back, what are the things I would have wanted to accomplish? And using that as kind of a tool or model for figuring out what to do in the present. What are the things that you feel like you'd regret not having done the most? And I'll go ahead and maybe preempt the spending time with family, with friends, et cetera, because I think those are given. But what are like those kind of cornerstone things that you want to do that you'll regret not having done?
I would like to speak Spanish at a high enough level that I could go to one of my, like, friends' weddings in Argentina and talk to their family in Spanish and, like, no issues. That's a pretty tangible one.
Same. I'm much farther behind you, but I share that one.
I think it's, I think, like, in America, we're pretty blessed to not have to learn a foreign language, but it's also kind of a handicap because we don't have to learn a foreign language. And it's hard to make yourself do it when you don't have to. Mm-hmm. But that's honestly probably one of the most just, like, yeah, I would like to do that. Publish a book, which I'm, like, working on the proposal right now. I've had an editor from Penguin Random House and reading my stuff for a while. She's been pushing me, and I've got an agent. I'm still, like, tweaking the proposal a little bit. So I think that one's probably going to happen in the next couple of years, but that is still one that, like, if I died tomorrow, I would be pissed that I hadn't, like, gotten that done.
Can you give us the gist of that one? I know it's still evolving.
Yeah, I mean, the very like high level is it's going to pull from a lot of stuff I've written, essentially, like kind of like what I was talking about with the whole like how we think about wealth, like how it kind of changes from when you don't have money to when you have money. And so it's kind of like that again, it's still pretty like fluid right now, but the first half is kind of reframing how we look at money over the course of our lives, and the second half is like that introducing this concept of opportunity cost, especially with respect to like how much time we have in our lives to spend that money. And then like finding the best ways to identify how to spend it over the course of our lives. So it's honestly just pulling a lot of my blog posts together and then a lot of ideas, like bits and pieces from a lot of different books, like Ramit's I'll Teach You to Be Rich. He's very good at like the explaining the like rich lifestyle, or Bill Perkins, Die with Zero. I thought his model of like spending your money down over the course of your life is like a phenomenal way of framing it. So I've kind of got a lot of those ideas like a they've kind of like coagulated. It's like a conglomeration of different ideas in my head that I really just need to put in word, but it's still in the proposal stage right now. So
the final product is going to be different. Why go the conventional publishing route versus self-publishing, given the reach you have?
Off the rip, I've noticed just talking to my agent about the proposal, it's so nice having someone to bounce ideas off of that's like, no, this isn't good. No, this is. Because he's right. Like anytime he has any kind of criticism, I look at it and I was like, yep, that totally checks out. It's good to have that extra set of eyes on stuff. There's a lot of logistical stuff with like book publishing that I just hadn't even thought of, like international distribution rights. Amazon's great for the US and North America. Then you're trying to sell books under completely different rights in the UK or Spain or Germany or like India or South Korea or Japan. And it just gets like really chaotic to the point that I don't know if you're actually going to be making any additional money once you start hitting the international markets. Like there's just so many, I don't know. It's essentially like, how much money am I willing to pay to not have to deal with the administrative headache is kind of what it comes down to. And there's the added benefit of like traditional publishers are a lot more tied in with like New York Times, Wall Street Journal, like all that stuff matters. I can say that, oh no, I don't need any traditional media. A lot of people are still treating traditional media as their media. And again, it's still it's a signaling thing. Like books that go through traditional publishers typically just look better. One of the only people I know who I think is really crushing it self-publishing, Paul Millard with The Pathless Path, phenomenal job. He's gotten offers to republish, but the publishing house doesn't want to do it. But it also almost benefits him that he is self-publishing because his entire book is about doing uncharted paths. It's right. Like it plays into his market
there.
Yeah, like it's a very good branding strategy for him not to use a publisher. Like he probably gets honestly more clout from not using a publisher because of the content of the book. If I was him, would have done the exact same thing. I don't think he should ever use a publisher. And he's kind of figured out how to do it, but it's still been like he had to hire like a freelancer for the design and like had to talk to a lot of people about international rights. Like it wasn't easy. Like he had to put a lot of work in on that to kind of figure out how to do it. I really just don't want to deal with all that stuff.
Yeah, that's totally fair. All right, I cut you off. Are there any other things you would regret not having done? We've got Spanish and publishing a book.
Yeah, I would like to go to every continent just to say I've done it. I probably
what are you going to do in Antarctica?
Look at some penguins. Nice. You can take a cruise from Ushuaia, Argentina, on like the southern tip to Antarctica.
I met somebody who did that. Yeah,
really. It's going through the Francis Strait, named after Francis Drake, down there between Antarctica and Latin America is apparently just like pretty hellish waters, but. I feel like it won't be that hard to go to Australia. Like I think at some point maybe in the next year or two, I'll do that. Antarctica is one where you really have to like find a reason and plan to do it. I'm pissed I didn't go when I was in Argentina a couple of years ago, because like you could get to Ushuaia from Buenos Aires on a flight in like 3 hours and then take the boat, but it was expensive. And it's like, you're on that boat for a week. Like you have to have a week where you're just not doing anything but going to Antarctica. And I just didn't have time. But I think that would be a cool one. Going to every country, I don't really plan to do that. But I've already been to every continent except for Australia and Antarctica. So 26, like it won't be that hard to hit two more. I just need to do it.
Yeah, you've got time. I've got two more questions if you're cool with that.
Yeah.
Zooming out on the creator space generally, although maybe for just because of your area of expertise, thinking about kind of text media, whether it has to do with social like Twitter and LinkedIn or long form like newsletters or books like we were just talking about, what changes or like evolutions maybe that other people would find surprising or like unconventional or unpopular do you see happening, call it over the next 5 to 10 years? Like where are things trending towards that maybe people aren't aware of yet, or where are their opportunities?
I think that the cost of having your own miniature media operation have dropped to almost zero, where, for example, like I use like Beehive is my email platform, but there's a lot of good ones. Beehive, Substack, ConvertKit, like they all work well depending on what your needs are. But the fact that anybody can spin one of those up without having to build your whole tech stack has made it where pretty much every organization kind of needs an email list. Like if we're sticking with text-based stuff, even if it's just for like communication purposes, like it's so hard to reach people if you're not in their inbox, because if you're just tweeting stuff out, the odds of somebody seeing a tweet basically zero unless it gets a lot of engagement. Right. With email, you don't have to play those engagement baits. That's part of the reason I can write a lot more authentically on my blog, on my newsletter, because like it's going to their inbox. They might not open it every time. Like you can game the subject line a little bit, I guess. But for the most part, once people trust you enough to subscribe to something, they're going to keep reading it. So I think you're going to see a lot more companies that start doubling down on having their own like smaller, maybe not like media teams per se, but they're at least going to have some kind of like email operation, because you kind of need text-based stuff. And you become a lot less dependent on having PR teams putting stuff out in like Financial Times and New York Times and Wall Street Journal if you're really good at social. Like if you can get a decent Twitter and LinkedIn presence, then you can get your own eyeballs without having to pay for media. So I think we're starting to see an inflection point where people who are good at social and that have figured out like the newsletter game, like having your own, like instead of being a journalist for the Wall Street Journal, if there's an industry you've been reporting on or interested in where a company in that sector, whether it's a VC firm investing in it, it could be like, I don't know, like Chobani, the yogurt company, paying $200,000 for a ghostwriter to basically work with their CEO. That's such a valuable thing if it gets them a lot better LinkedIn and Twitter coverage, if they're putting out better annual reports, like blog post articles and thought pieces by the CEO. There's just so many ways to leverage good content that can be repurposed across the socials for free marketing, that can be embedded in email for like keeping your current audience or community invested. Where it used to be, okay, like Morning Brew really like absolutely crushed it on the email newsletter game. And The Hustle did that. And like with ExecSum, we're doing the same thing. But there's a lot of things where you're not just a media company in the email or in the inbox as much as that's just part of your broader media strategy to have like an email list with content where you're not monetizing the content. The content's part of a broader, like instead of paying for like Facebook ads, you're putting out good content that's like creating brand awareness. So I think there's going to be a lot of job opportunities for people who can write well, who really understand social media, where like, and this is something I've talked to people about more and more, where it's like, okay, putting out more blogs and stuff on the website that can be redistributed and repurposed as social content that can also be shared in emails. Like, how does all that fit together? People who are both good writers and good at content strategy are going to have a lot of opportunities if they know how to sell themselves. And that's like, I'm literally doing a couple of projects like that with, I have no idea if I could talk about that, like what they are, but I'm working on like a couple of those right now. Just because I understand Twitter, LinkedIn, and email a little bit better than a lot of other people do. Like Nick Majuli had he has a finance blog, Dollars and Data. And he, in one of his posts like a year or two ago, he was talking about how instead of being like the 99th percentile at XYZ thing, if you can be like in the 80th or 90th percentile, two things, maybe content strategy and writing, where you know how to write pretty well and you know how to market it pretty well, that can put you in like a very niche category of people who are really good at the overlap of those things. And I think like text-based media-wise, it's going to be all these little like mini niche media teams and then companies where they pay one or two people a decent salary to like be a big part of their marketing department.
That's one of the things I've been mulling over. I wouldn't say I have like the expertise or the skill set, but this idea because the cost and barrier to content creation has been, especially around text and the ability to move the same ideas around different mediums and platforms has been dramatically lowered. It's something I've thought a lot about, but need to hone to the point of, I think Scott Adams also calls that idea that Nick called skill stacking.
Yeah.
I need to kind of hone my skill stack a little bit more in that area. And I think email, it's funny because email has been around for forever, and people still maybe underestimate the value of it. It is the only place, aside from maybe having somebody's phone number, which is a little bit more personal and sensitive, where you can get direct access, like disintermediated access to them. Everything else has a platform or somebody kind of brokering the experience. It's the only thing that's guaranteed access. And so I think, yeah, more people are going to have to make that a key part of their strategy.
Yep.
Well, in closing, I always ask the same final question, which is to turn it back around on you. What's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I think it'll go back to like one of those ideas I was highlighting a little bit, but if you were like, for anybody that's really trying to figure out what to do with their life, whether it's career stuff, relationship stuff, just like more holistic, anything. Instead of trying to figure out what should I do now to do next, like we tend to look at stuff from the bottom up, like I'm here, what do I want to do? Boom, 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 boom. Look at it from the top down. It's literally the question you asked me earlier. What's the stuff that 60 years from now you're going to wish you had done, and then work backwards from that to figure out what you need to do for the next step to get there.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, Jack, thank you so much for your time. This was a ton of fun. Maybe when you publish that book, we can bring you back on.
100%. Thank you, Spencer.